Recorded live in downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome everyone to Season 1, Episode 10 of Rancho Notorious. I'm Dance Levin, and with me at Rancho tonight we have
Kaylee.
Live. Hi,
oh,
Kaylee.
Sorry, I need to scoot down. My mic has dropped.
Right. Oh, yeah.
There we go.
We made some adjustments technically, and it's not really worked, has it?
But no.
That's okay. Because we love you, we're not going to start the show again.
No.
We are going to give you the full...
I'm here now.
Live, as live, as if you were with us here at Rancho Notorious. On the Skype line in Auckland, we're joined by Liam McGurran, reviewer, blogger and cartoonist for flicks.co.nz. Liam, g'day.
Hello, my mic's still on my table.
Excellent.
Well, we know what choice of refreshment and beverage you've chosen for to get you through the next hour. So let's hope... Let's hope that it remains on your table by the end, or if you're under the table, then perhaps you can take the microphone with you when you go.
Yep.
On today's show, we find out how excited Kaylee is about going back to Canada and then on to two different film festivals. Liam and I will taste... who wrote this rubbish? I think I wrote it. Plus, Liam and I will taste a blending of Indian and French cuisine concocted by Oprah Winfrey and Lassie Hallström. And we'll also be tasting that subtle blend of action and nostalgia that only Sylvester Stallone can come up with, The Expendables 3. All that, plus the usual glut of news, stats and opinion. But first, Kaylee, you have a mailbag.
I do. Well, I won't go into the whole discussion, but there's a very salacious discussion around guest badges on our Twitter account.
We lost track of that, didn't we? We lost control of that conversation, which does happen on social media.
Yeah, but it was great. So thank you to Shay Tibby for that fantastic...
For that image. Yeah, good
of
one.
People paying and sleeping their way onto the show. That doesn't happen.
But it's a good idea, though, and and so Liam, you're lucky you're on the on the end of a of an internet connection rather than here with us in the studio, because you know there might be a toll to be paid.
Well, I still had to be on my knees in order to get to the show. Begging.
Maybe we could go for like a... I think I'd be more comfortable with like maybe a shoulder massage, like over the clothes. That's about it.
Okay.
All right. Oh yeah, I'd love one.
Yeah. RJ Movie says, I can't remember if I read this last week or not, but I'm going to read it again because it's good. Two word review for Hercules: myth busted. Boom.
That was a good one.
Yeah. And Fred Thompson, two word review for Palo Alto: teenage angst. Follows normal high school film tropes, but the impressive young cast sets it apart from others.
Now, we didn't actually do Palo Alto on the show, so luckily we have Fred, who's going to fill in all the gaps for us. What I could do is I did actually review Palo Alto for a larger
small magazine that you may or may not edit.
Yeah, that's right, for the magazine that I edit. And also I managed to get double duty out of that because I did that for 9 to Noon on Radio New Zealand as well. So I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So if you want to know what I thought of Palo Alto, short version, two words, not much, you can find it there. Is that one that's been on your radar, Liam?
I didn't see it, although I do like to see James Franco creeping up on teenage schoolgirls. Is it worth it for that?
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's all it is.
Oh, maybe. Great.
Maybe it's great. I don't know.
It's not.
Oh.
That's another two-word review.
Right.
It's not.
Oh.
And I'm on fire tonight.
Oh. And from Reese Pie, it's part of a larger article, which we can link to in the show notes. She says, I am a rushed independent movie selective, apparently, based on a Screen Daily article
It's one of those. It's one of those little survey things. You answer questions, and it tells you what kind of person you are, and in this case, what kind of moviegoer you are. Yeah.
Oh, this is exactly the thing that I need.
Yeah, to know what kind of person you are, or to know what kind of moviegoer you are.
Yeah, I'll probably get something really rude.
Yeah. Well,
stay at home. Yeah. That again,
check out the show notes, and you'll be able to compare yourself with us. Oh, and you're handing the phone back. So that means that is the entire contents of the mailbag. I should point out to those of you who are even the slightest bit interesting that because of Kaylee's impending travel schedule. Well, some people are interested in the movies part, but not always interested in the mechanics of how we put it.
Slightly interesting people. People are interested. Anyway.
What if you're too interesting? Does that mean you're exempt from this?
Yes.
It's been a long day. anyway, just that we're recording this on a Tuesday instead of a normal Thursday night. We'll still post this on the usual day, which is Friday, by which time the world may have come to an end. But because Kaylee's travelling, aren't you? You know, you got one more day in Wellington before you fly out, or not even that much?
Not even that much. I fly out tomorrow afternoon.
Right.
And evening. Have to get to Auckland first.
Auckland first. Oh, yeah. Bad luck. And what's the itinerary after that?
Well, I am flying to my motherland to go to
Canada.
Oh, Canada. Canada. To go to a family event. Very excited about. I'll be in Vancouver for about a week. And then I'm going down to the Telluride Film Festival, where I'll be volunteering at concessions, which means I will be selling popcorn and hot dogs.
Snickers.
And Snickers.
Yeah.
And whatever else.
And
Junior mints. I don't need them all.
Exactly. You'll be making popcorn for Alexander Payne. I can see it now.
Yeah. And hopefully, some other great people. And then I will be... For the first time ever, I'm taking a train. I'm taking the Amtrak over to Chicago, and I'll be in Chicago for a week, checking out Chicago for all it is. They have some beautiful classic theaters there, so I'm looking forward to checking those out, and also going to the Great American Bacon Festival, because it just happens to be on when I'm there. So, I can tell you all about bacon.
Oh, if you don't already follow Kaylee on Twitter, this is the time... to do so, because I would imagine there's going to be a lot of kind of bacon flavored tweets coming out.
Yes, and Instagrams.
Instagram. Yeah, no, I have yet to be won over to the charms of Instagram. Okay.
Well, I'll make sure to tweet my Instagrams so like everyone can enjoy the bacon photos and the traveling photos. And then after the Great American Bacon Festival and catching up with some very, very talented friends of mine, I am going to be up in Toronto to catch the sort of tail end of the Toronto International Film Festival for the very first time.
All the films that you missed while you were working behind the counter in Telluride.
Yes, such a hard life. So that is going to be very exciting. I'm not sure how many films I'll be able to get to because of the timing of when their schedule is released and when the tickets go on sale. But the friends I'll be staying with are very much into film as well. So it should be a good time, even if we just lurk around.
I was reading tweets from... Sakura 59, a longtime friend of the show, she's also going to be in Toronto for the festival, and she was tweeting about how they're announcing a sort of ticket sales window for Toronto, and I couldn't understand what on earth that was about. Can you enlighten me about do you know what that means in terms of ticket sales? It seemed like that once you've sort of enrolled to go to the festival, they then allocate you a period of time where you're allowed to buy your tickets. And if you're in like band number two, some of your sessions might already be sold out. And it was like, is this not all happening on the internet? Can they not handle the traffic?
Is she going as media or is she going just as general?
Oh, maybe
I don't know how
it.
Any of it works, but I do know that it is a bit of a lottery system. And like now even though they haven't announced their full program, you can buy ticket packages. So instead of just right now, you can't buy individual tickets. You can just buy a random package. So I don't know if it's like a lucky dip.
Oh, that would be so awesome. They should do that here in New Zealand. You should just be able to buy like a 6-film random package and, for like next to no money, obviously, because you wouldn't want to splash out. But still, you know, that's sort of how I go to the film festival anyway. Mm. Is like you just throw darts at a film festival program and then see what you get. You know,
Like shove you into the unpopular films that no one else would actually want to see because they're bad. Like, I don't know, How to Be a God.
Yeah, How to Be a God is going to be a legendary title in future, isn't it? It's going to be the one that all really, really difficult films are measured against.
There were some amazing review tweets about that, mostly about genitalia and poos.
And poos. I got. I was. I don't know. Fortunate. Unfortunate. How? I got a screener of that before the film festival because in order to write my preview for the magazine, and I got 20 minutes through that, and it's a 3-hour film. I just knew that I couldn't do any more of that than, you know, and I'm usually pretty sturdy. I'm made of sturdy stuff usually, you know. The only other films I've ever walked out on have been English comedies based on television shows.
Sorry, I just made a face at Dan. Our listeners couldn't see. But I will be in Vancouver for VIFF as well.
So. Oh, a third for yet another film festival.
Excellent.
Outrageous. All right, well, I'm so envious of you. I'm going to call a halt to this part of the conversation and let's move on to what have New Zealanders been watching this weekend if they haven't been at the film festival? Yeah, so,
I'm not even paying attention.
No, you're not. You're on holiday in your mind.
I'm on holiday time.
Yeah, so check out the Comic Sans stylings.
The Comic Sans stylings of this week at the New Zealand box office. Number 5, Mrs. Brown's Boys the Movie. At least it's going down. Number 4, The Dark Horse. Still in the top 5, which is awesome. Opening at number 3, The Expendables 3. Oh, good timing. In at number 2, up from 7, The 100-Foot Journey. I'm assuming the numbers from last week were snakes?
I must have been, yeah.
They were, previews.
Yeah. Okay, and staying up at the number 1 spot is Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, on 2.7 million. That's just up until Sunday night, actually. So, yeah, just includes the weekend.
Goodness.
Now, in Australia, meanwhile, he said, reaching for his own particular listing, top 5 there, Hercules, last weekend, down from number 4. That has made $7.75 million in Australia, in Australian dollars. Number 4, Lucy, yet to arrive here in New Zealand, but already in week 3 in Australia. The Expendables 3, straight in at number 3. The 100-Foot Journey, similar trajectory, actually, as here in New Zealand. Number 2, Guardians of the Galaxy, number 1, making just pots and pots of money for whoever is in charge of that.
And the US box office in at number 5, The Giver, which I'm looking forward to seeing. I have one movie day in Vancouver when I arrive before I go to Telluride, and I think I'm going to see The Giver, although I don't know what's coming out.
Oh, you're not going to go and see the Step Up film for us?
Well, it's going to be a toss up. It's going to be, maybe we'll have to do some bargaining.
I'm going to see Step Up 5, and I am so, so, so excited.
I really want to see it. I do. But I also really want to see The Giver because I read it as a kid and had to write pages and pages of it in English class.
So when you read it as a kid, who did you cast in your mind as the lead?
I don't know. I just sort of make people up. Like, I'm a visual... it sounds weird to say. It was like I can visualize things when I read.
Right.
I was gonna say I was a visual reader.
You visualize things when you read. That's remarkable.
It's very cinematic. I read and it's very cinematic and I just like make up people.
Wow. So that's great that you can do that because I always, every novel that I read, I cast them using actual people.
You?
Yeah.
That must be so difficult. Like as soon as you come across a new person, do you have to like put down the book and think?
No, because it changes. Really it does change. No, because they always start off as like Sean Connery, I think.
That's
and
deep.
Then I work my way around.
That is deep. Moving up the list, I feel like I know so much about you now. Number 4, The Expendables 3. Number 3, Let's Be Cops. which looks awful.
And a terrible, terrible time to be putting out a funny movie about really bad cops in America. Yeah. But still, $26 million.
Yeah. Number two, Guardians of the Galaxy. And in the number one spot, another one I might go see because my brother might want to come along too, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Are you going to do the music again for us like last week?
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Excellent.
I don't even know. That's not even the right key, but does it matter?
Maybe you and Liam could harmonize over Skype.
Maybe. Honestly. I feel like we'd need a bit of practice, though.
I can beatbox while you do the ninja rap.
Oh!
Okay, go for it.
Oh!
That's not even the rhythm. Sorry. I'm just going.
I don't know the turtle rap.
Never mind. Now, for those of you that are hanging out waiting for the UK box office, I just should just point out that they are selectards and
their week from Rancho Podcast.
Their weekend.
Selectard.
Well, their weekend appears. They just haven't got their box office figures out. It is a Tuesday,
they do
of course.
Not
it's
have only, their stuff together.
It's only just Monday in the UK, so that would explain perhaps why that is. We're not going to do a random Eastern European country or Third World or Latin American country this time around because it was kind of depressing how it was basically the same as everywhere else. But we will get back into that next week.
Speaking of Twitter, if you have any requests of what you'd like me to see while I'm in North America so I don't have to actually make a choice, let me know.
Yeah.
Just Google Vancouver Showtimes, see what comes up. And be like, hey, you should go see that because I'd like to know what your opinion is on that.
And tell her which bus that she needs to get and basically just make all those decisions for her. Because you know what people are like on holiday? They don't want to have to think.
No.
Are we hungry? Because it's time, I think, for a food film.
100 feet across the street, the restaurant has a Michelin star. The President of France dines there.
Can Mr. President order murgh masala, cooked the way Hassan cooks?
People here don't eat those things.
They have never tried. Now they shall.
We open Saturday night. My son is the best Indian chef in Europe. Raise your hand. Don't feel shy.
Don't raise your hand.
Raise your hand, Hassan. I'm talking to you. Begin.
Yay! If your food is anything like your music, I suggest you turn it down.
I will turn the music down, but I will turn the heat up.
You don't know when enough is enough.
Enough of you.
Papa, relax.
What do you mean relax? Spoil the whole game.
Two screen legends united for the first time. Om Puri, the Indian actor, and Helen Mirren in The 100-foot journey. Has anyone got an ability to turn that into metric for those of you who aren't in the United States? I'm looking at Kaylee.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no. You see, the thing about you, Kaylee, is that you're not allowed to review anything at the moment, which means that when we do the reviews, you just switch off, don't you? You just
don't make that body language like I'm twee about it. I'm
so
reading
ahead. Okay, so while Liam and I are talking about the...
I'm going to do some calculations for
23.7 meters.
There we go. Thank you, Liam.
Which is the way it should be. I'm
going to go back to reading my news.
Don't look that up because I'm probably wrong.
I'm sorely tempted to do this entire review in a fake French accent, like Ellen Mirren as all the way through the film.
Do you want me to be Indian? Oh God!
Because you can do a French accent and people think it's funny. You do an Indian accent and it's just no. Bad things happen as a result of that. No, so we won't. But I have to say that, you know, Helen Mirren, one of the great screen actors of our time, with a fantastic body of work to her name. What is she doing in this, Liam?
Being French.
Well, not,
and being
not
really
terribly
angry
French.
About it.
Well, I think maybe she's angry at the number of zeros that aren't on her paycheck. Maybe she's being paid in euros instead of dollars or something. I don't know. It's a cliched French character, but she doesn't sound particularly French. Mind you, I have to say that even the French people speaking in English don't sound particularly French. It's like they're all putting an accent on.
Yeah, especially with Helen Mirren, because she goes into French mode and then just suddenly drops it at points.
Mm.
It's almost when she just has to say a simple sentence that she goes back to super British.
And it's... It's like a lot of films that are set in a country that doesn't speak English, but the market for it is predominantly English. There seems to be a kind of randomness about when they actually speak French and when they speak English. You know, it's like, why are you people are all French in the room together. Why are you speaking in English to each other?
I got more frustrated with the Indian family, and especially the father, because then there'd be specific moments where he sort of gets frustrated himself and then rambles on in Hindi.
Which is at least kind of authentic. I mean,
it is authentic, yeah. But it's kind of jarring when the rest of the time he's talking in English to his family when they're just by themselves in private.
He's probably swearing. Maybe that's it. I should just give people, for those of you that are unfamiliar with the background of the film of which we speak, The 100-Foot Journey is a best-selling novel championed by Oprah Winfrey and her book club. And she is, in fact, a producer on this film. Her Harpo company have put money into it. So not only has she tapped this book on the shoulder, metaphorically speaking, and turned it into a bestseller, she's also... Chosen out of all the books. I mean, I think what was the last Oprah Winfrey book that got made into a film? Was it Eat, Pray, Love? I'm expecting one of you to know the Oprah Winfrey oeuvre better than I.
books that were in her book club?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Eat, Pray, Love. There's probably a whole bunch of them that made it onto TV.
Right.
Because I think she produces a lot of those, like, Hallmark Sunday late
night. Did she help produce The Butler?
Maybe.
Anyway, as usual, we're all a little bit underprepared for this show, me especially. But I would say, so you want to know the plot, don't you? I suppose that would be important. An Indian family who leave Mumbai in a hurry for reasons that don't appear to make an enormous amount of sense. Their restaurant is torched. And they leave and they become refugees in England. They decide that England is a little bit too wet for them, so they pile all their belongings into a car, drive around Europe until they find an idyllic, cliched French village that's like straight out of Jacques Tati film, and decide that there is where they're going to restart their great Mumbai restaurant. And it just happens to be across the road from a one Michelin starred classic French cliched establishment owned by Helen Mirren with a stick up her ass and a bunch of kitchen staff who, you know, some of them don't appear to actually sort of be of a terribly high standard. So that one star would appear to be in some jeopardy, I would have thought. It turns out that the son of Om Puri, the main chef, main cook at the Indian restaurant across the road, is some kind of savant, genius cook who can pick up all of these incredibly difficult culinary skills without any training whatsoever. It looks like he's going to be the saviour of both restaurants. Is that a pretty good summing up? Have I missed anything there, Liam?
Yeah, it's not just that he's a chefing genius. This dude is a total nerd for food, kind of like how we're nerds for film and cinema, to where he would pick up a fruit, take one whiff of it, and would know the the very mechanics of everything that would combine with, flavor-wise.
Yeah.
Because he's just that in tune with food. And he loves to experiment with different flavors. And
well, he does. He does love to experiment. But all of his experiments end up being chucking Indian spices at something, and that's he manages to build a career that takes him all the way to Paris and that sort of gastronomic science project restaurant that we're all so fond of making fun of these days. This is an easy film to be critical of because it's soft in all the, you know, the right and wrong places at the same time. You know, it's a real crowd pleasing movie in that, you know, it follows an arc that people can get behind. It's got a happy ending. It's got some romance. People love food on the big screen, you know, and the food is reasonably well presented, I think, reasonably well photographed. In fact, the whole thing is pretty well photographed. Lassie Hallström, yeah, the director, knows what he's doing, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. It's interesting with foodie films because they tend to shoot them kind of like how Michael Bay would shoot women, where they'd just be glisteningly gratuitous close-ups, and they'd be all tarted up to make the audience's mouth water. But this isn't so much food porn as it is food romanticism.
Mm.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
And I think where it really falls down is that it flirts with the kind of cross-cultural drama that the film has and the story has a potential for, but it chooses not to really go into it in any great detail. There's a little bit of an acknowledgement of French, the French potential for bigotry and racism, but it tidies it all up a little bit too neatly, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of these little strands in the plot that it brings up but doesn't follow through with. Like, one that really got to me was something happens. It's a violent attack that reminds them of how that's very similar to how they lost their mother, their family, except no one ever really acknowledges it. And because it's based off a book, you kind of feel like in the book it would have had a greater effect on them. But in the movie, it just wipes it clean.
Yeah, I do feel it kind of tiptoes up to drama and then just goes, oh, you know, that's not what people are here for.
Also, with him realizing that cooking isn't just about growing through competition, it's about growing through collaboration, I was pretty disappointed that I didn't see more experimentation with Indian and French cuisine, like, I don't know, escargot vindaloo or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's all in one direction, isn't it? It's like we'll take his mum's suitcase full of spices and we'll add that to the omelette, or we'll add that to the beef bourguignon, and it'll just be a slightly spicy version of something French. But it doesn't go back across the road, does it? Like, what's it called? Chateau Mumbai or whatever it's called, or Maison Mumbai, the Indian restaurant across the road, doesn't change. And in fact, did you notice they never seem to actually have a single customer?
There's one scene where they had like three customers, and apparently that's meant to mean business is booming.
Yeah, very, very strange. Now, there's a couple other things that I observed, and I don't know if you saw these as well, Liam, and that is that it appears that everybody in France eats with a spoon.
Oh, really?
Did you notice that? Like our incredibly gifted Indian chef, not only is he fanatically talented, but he's also an angler. So he catches a fish from the river fresh as a gift for the mayor, in order to sort of smooth things over there. And the mayor eats this freshly cooked fish with a spoon.
Oh.
And his dad eats the beef bourguignon with a spoon. I was wondering whether there was perhaps something about French culture that I'd missed there, in terms of cutlery.
I think I've only ever had beef bourguignon with a spoon.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
I know that.
Is it
often
a soup?
I know that often in India, you're not given any cutlery for your food.
That's
not
why
all
you have
the time,
bread.
But quite often.
You scoop it up with the bread. That's how I eat it.
Yeah. No, and that's fine too. But we didn't actually see any of the Indian food being eaten, and it was just this French stuff, this French muck. And that confused me ever so slightly. But I mean, along with quite a lot of it, really. There's a romance. There's a pseudo romance in there.
Two romances.
Oh, there are. There are two romances.
One that annoyed me.
Well, perhaps you could explain why while I'm looking up the names of the actors of the other thing.
Because it gets wedged in the third act, and it just felt like it felt like the story just needed it to happen.
Oh, it did. I think it's because it's completely implausible for one reason, and also kind of icky for another. And it's like audiences would riot, wouldn't they? You know, your average Sunday afternoon matinee audience in New Zealand would riot if that loose end hadn't been tied up.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It doesn't really. They both have a similar past in regard to their partners, and yet that's never acknowledged either through their relationship. Figured that would be brought up at least once.
No, they're not. Obviously, the filmmakers have decided that they're not interesting enough to actually have emotional backstories.
Yeah, it just seems weird that they would actually bring it up at all if that was the case, instead of just cutting it.
I know there are so many frustrations about this film, and not I mean, there are a few pleasures in it as well. One of the pleasures is Charlotte Le Bon.
Charlotte Le Bon.
Who I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for a film that will cast somebody with teeth that crooked and have her still look absolutely gorgeous all the way through.
And you know what she looked absolutely gorgeous in? Yves Saint Laurent. She was great in that.
Oh, is she in that too? Mm-hmm. Is that one that did you see that at the film festival?
Sorry, her eyes just melt me. It's fading out.
Yeah, well, she never takes that eye makeup off, which, you know, so even when she's woken up by a stone at her window in the middle of the night, no, she's still, you know, she's still absolutely perfect.
Even when she's cooking with all that steam brushing up on her face, she still just looks amazing in that makeup.
Yeah, and I was just having a look on IMDb to find out whether she is actually related to the Duran Duran Le Bon, but apparently not. So that just happens to be coincidence. And the handsome Indian chef is Manish Dayal, and he looked vaguely familiar too. So I'm wondering where we might have known him from. And the answer is nothing.
One order is for you.
Eh? Yeah, Law and Order SVU, I don't watch, so there we go.
Looks like a lot of television.
90210, the series. Yeah, Law and Order Criminal. He's done lots of Law and Order. But that's the thing, is that when you're a good-looking Asian actor, the chances are you will be playing a terrorist or somebody suspected of being a terrorist at some point.
There was actually a good joke about that. At one point near the end, do you remember?
There was. We won't spoil it because some people may still, in fact, be awake at that point of the film. So
there were actually quite a few little cool turns of phrases, one involving washing a wall, which I won't give up.
Yeah, that was nice.
Yeah, and another one that really got to me was like, you're a chef, I don't pay you to burn things, which I think is a really cool double entendre when you learn about it.
I thought that there was one other phrase, and this is perhaps one of the more sentimental aspects of the film, which I liked. And I imagine this is the point in the novel when somebody producing films would read it and go, "Oh, we can work with this." And that is where I think it's is it his mother in the flashback says, "Food is memory."
Yeah,
which I thought, oh right, now I know, you know, that's really what they want everyone to take from the film, and indeed I got it. That's the 100-foot journey, Lassie Hallström. Actually made me want to go back and look at the Cider House Rules, which is one of his films that I really did like, and you know, he's a filmmaker that has enormous talent, but it just ends up being sort of suckered into these really sort of sentimental films. Have you seen Chocolat? My partner was telling me that we should see that we at some point.
Such
we should,
a good one,
right? There you go. Yeah, Liam, you may not realize this, but we have in fact brought back the two-word review. So I'm going to put you on the spot here, and feel free to take as much time as you like while I think of mine.
Okay, my two-word review for the 100-foot journey is for mum.
Yeah, very nice, very nice. Mine would be masala custard.
Oof.
Yeah, rubbish, eh? This is why I shouldn't play this game. And but no, here I am. I've been persuaded that we have to do it. So I humiliate myself every week on this two-word review thing.
Okay, but you know what? Next week I can start doing reviews.
Oh, God, so I'm going to get beaten by a girl.
Fighting words.
Time for some news.
Speaking of news, are those new shoes? Those are nice shoes.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, they're good. They're good. In news that we missed last week because of sadder events, the New York Film Festival announced the 30 titles that will make up their main slate for the event that opens on September 26th. Oh, I'm going to be missing that one.
Yeah, this is one of those. This is one of those festivals that actually announces their program. Mm, yeah.
Ugh, who knew? David Fincher's Gone Girl will open the Shindig. Paul Thomas Anderson's Inherent Vice, which I really want to see, and I know is playing at TIFF.
Is it playing at TIFF?
It's rumored to be playing at TIFF.
No, I thought that they'd made an announcement and said that they weren't going to be ready. They'd already said that they won't be ready for Venice Telluride TIFF, which is that triumvirate. So
maybe I dreamed it.
Mm. But Gone Girl, I would bet good money that Gone Girl will be at a Telluride for you.
I wonder what David Fincher likes to eat.
What kind of popcorn?
Popcorn, Snickers, Maltesers, hot dogs.
Give it to him in a head-shaped box.
Because Ben Affleck's in it, isn't he? Isn't Ben Affleck the male lead in Gone Girl? Am I thinking of the right film? I think he might be. And Ben Affleck, of course, had tremendous success at the Telluride that I was there. Did I ever tell you that I went to Telluride?
No. You should give me some tips. Inherent Vice is the centerpiece gala, and Alejandro Iñárritu. Is that right?
Yeah, I didn't put all of the pronunciation guides on that.
Oh, no.
But close enough.
Alejandro's Birdman is the closing night on October 12th. Really good festival.
It is a good festival. Mm-hmm. I mean, just those three alone. Mm. Boom.
And in more good news, the Dark Horse has a sales agent in time for TIFF. Seville International is the boutique sales arm of Entertainment One, the huge Canadian company that now owns Hopscotch Films in Australia, for example. Woo.
Yeah, so that was big news that came out today, and I would say that that's a very good sign for the Dark Horse getting a lot more international exposure and attention.
Definitely. And Leonard Maltin has announced that the 2015 edition of the Legendary Film Guide will be the last. Maltin said today, with ready access to information on the internet, our readership has diminished at an alarming rate. The book's loyal followers know that we strive to offer something one can't easily find online, curated information that is accurate and user-friendly, along with our own reviews and ratings. But with a growing number of people who believe that everything should be free, it's impossible to support a reference book that requires a staff of contributors and editors.
It's kind of sad, but also that is one of the more passive-aggressive au revoirs that I've come across in recent times.
Leonard, you've done this to yourself!
Yeah, and you know, I think it is fair enough. I mean, when you've got a site like Rotten Tomatoes or what's the other review gathering?
Metacritic,
that's the one. Kaylee and I know a cinema that actually doesn't even print reviews anymore from particular reviewers. They just pin up the Rotten Tomatoes page for a particular film, and it's like, it used to be part of the fun job of owning a cinema was that you would go and find the great reviews, and you would, you know, the ones that are really going to appeal to your kind of audience, the ones that people would recognize, and then you would pin those up. And now, I mean, it just seems kind of lazy that we just go to Rotten Tomatoes. People are going to walk into the theater and they'll look and they'll go, oh, it's fresh. It's 75% fresh. I trust it. Instead of going A.O. Scott or Roger Ebert or Bradshaw or Tuckett or whatever, you know, or Flix for that matter, you know, it's like,
what are they going to do for movies like Transformers that have like 30% on Rotten Tomatoes?
Yeah, it's not one of the films that they play. I take your point, you know. Mind you, if they were looking for good reviews on that one, they would end up at WEXT Cincinnati, like the film companies do.
They'd be relying on tweets.
Yeah,
in fact, some people have done that.
But horrifying. But it's not just about new films either. You know, Maltin used to be the place you went. You used to carry. I do know people who carried the book to the video shop with them. You know, and now there's no need to do that. We don't have video shops for a start. So it's a shame because it was a remarkable book, the Maltin book, because even though he didn't write all those reviews, no one could. It sounded like he did. You know, like it had that voice. It is the end of an era, and I think we should all buy that last copy so that we've got something a version of it on the other one. There was the English version, which was Halliwell's Film Guide. Did you ever see that one, Liam?
No, but I grew up on the 2005 Leonard Maltin review edition. I think it was 2005 when I was still in school
in short pants and it's, you know, but you can, but that 2005 edition would have stood you in good stead for a long time.
Oh, totally. I was hooked on that. Yeah. Introduced me to a whole bunch of films I never would have found myself.
So the end of an era. Just looking at talking of video and looking at what's happening in the world of video this weekend, new cinema releases coming back into home video, Noah, this week, Transcendence, which I missed earlier on in the year, and actually Divergent, which I also missed, because I've been busy this year. So which one of those would you recommend, Liam? Noah,
funnily enough.
Right.
I felt a little abandoned because I thought more people would like it as much as I did, but I think I'm kind of alone on it.
Your cartoon was great.
Oh, thank you.
I enjoyed the Noah cartoon. I find it quite funny.
I really appreciated the fact that Noah didn't pretend to be a film that it wasn't. You know, like it was a big budget film that had, you know, weirdness threaded all the way through it.
A film of biblical
proportions. Especially that third act.
Yeah. So, you know, you got to respect something like that. It sort of knew who it was. Anyway, straight to video this week, we have a film called GBF, which I've never heard of, and a 2011 film from Francis Coppola called Twixt.
GBF is Gay Best Friend, and it played at Outtakes, I believe.
Oh, okay. Mm. Right, so there you go. So if you can't get to the movies this weekend, maybe you can get to a video shop or some kind of downloading service. It's time for another review. I've completely done this in the wrong order. Yeah, it is. What's next?
That was better than your last segue, by the way.
Yeah, well, my segues are weak. Your segues are weak, old man.
We were close once. We started this whole Expendables thing together. But we had a falling out.
What are you gonna do?
Reload.
This is it? This is your team?
Short notice.
Yeah, very short.
You were stupid enough to get yourself into this mess! We're the only ones crazy enough to get you out of it!
How hard can it be to kill 10 men?
Insane.
Courageous.
But insane.
What are you going to do?
I love in that little bit of audio, it basically has all of the strengths and weaknesses of that film in one go. We've got Jason Statham putting on an English accent in order to be more Cockney than he actually is. You know, like that's a stage English accent that he's doing there. We've got Antonio Banderas doing Puss in Boots, which is,
even has those eyes. He's even bowing down to Stallone with those Puss in Boots eyes. Please take me with you. I will be also loyal.
It's fantastic. You cross the road for him. And it also has, what else have we got going on there? We've got Mel Gibson actually acting. Like, Mel Gibson's in a different film to everybody else. He's really good.
He's such a great, horrible human being. Who would have thought?
Exactly. And then you've got Stallone, and you can't understand a word he says. You know, that's pretty much that is the film in that 30-second nutshell. I don't know about you, Liam, I had real problems actually understanding anything that anybody said in this film. There's talk that the opening weekend box office for Expendables 3 is so poor because there's been so much downloading, you know, that they're actually already blaming the amount of piracy that's hurt the box office. But I kind of wish I'd pirated it, because then I could have put the subtitles on it and understood what was going on.
You should just do what I do and just imagine the words. Like, what are you gonna do? Watch TV, have a quiet drink, just chill out for a bit.
You can probably then, therefore, based on the fact that you're using your own imagination to work this out, you can tell me what was the plot? What actually happens in Expendables 3?
Okay, so Stallone saves an Expendable, and then he realizes that another Expendable who he thought was dead is actually alive, and he's an evil Expendable. So the other Expendables have to go kill this Expendable, but Stallone's like, nah, you're too old. And so he goes by himself and gets some new Expendables to kill the evil Expendable. But then the new Expendables... Okay, I'll stop there, because there is actually one spoiler.
We don't want to go there. Isn't it interesting how... Oh, this is probably a spoiler too, but I think people will have forgotten by the time they get to this point. Isn't this interesting how basically none of them are expendable? You know, like three films in, the Expendables, they've all got the tattoos and what have you.
You know who's the only expendable in this film? Terry Crews. Because the start of the film introduces another black man. That's Wesley Snipes. That's two black men in the Expendables. Yeah. And then Terry Crews
spends the rest of the film wired to one of those machines in the hospital that goes beep.
Yep. Because they had doubled on their black man quota.
Yeah, so to answer you, Kaylee, yes, they all have matching tattoos. They all have their expendable skull. Now, because their logo, correct me if I'm wrong here, Liam, is basically, is it like a crow shitting on a skull? Isn't it basically, you know, the logo on the painted on the plane that's supposed to be top secret that, you know, that everyone can see whenever they land?
Yeah, I actually thought it was a shark jumping over the skull, but turns out I was wrong. It is a crow. Looking very disappointed that there's no more meat on the bone, but, you know, it still keeps on pecking at that bone, thinking there's more meat to it. It's very symbolic.
Were you familiar with the franchise before this?
Yeah, I hated the first one so much. It really felt it was creative in its action, and it wasn't. It was just boring.
And that was the one that Stallone directed himself, wasn't it, that first one?
Yeah. And it's the only one that actually shows blood.
Right.
As R16, and actually had gore in it. The second one I thought was great. It was one of the funniest comedies I saw that year. And I wish I saw it again because it was just so damn funny.
It was good. I saw that on the way to Telluride, actually, in fact, in a little town called Gunnison, Colorado. And me and the two other people in the movie theater, we really enjoyed it. And it seemed like the tone issues of that first one had been sort of resolved, and they realized that actually what the public really wanted was to see these old guys acknowledge their oldness and then have stuntmen do incredible things in their name, and then close up back to the old guys again, winking at each other, basically. And it's like it did that pretty well.
Yeah, I thought so. Even if most of its laughs weren't actually intentional, but I was entertained as hell.
Yeah, but this third one, it seems like they don't trust that the old guys are going to keep people's interest anymore, because they've got to get all these new guys in. And did you recognize any of them from anything? Like, I like to think that I'm reasonably clued up about popular culture, but none of these people were familiar to me.
Did you think that hacker looked like Chris Evans' less successful younger brother?
I thought that, actually, now that you mention it, I think they all look like various big stars, less successful younger brothers. Yep. Because there was, I thought that the moody bearded one looked like he could have been Chris Pine's younger brother as well. So actually, that's probably, yeah, that you can tell what the casting call was for these guys. Yeah. There's a lot to criticize about this film. Is there anything that you enjoyed?
I enjoyed that it tried its darndest at the end, because if you're just going for ship blowing up, ship blows up, and at least there's some clarity this time to the blowing of the shit. But now I have to go back to my criticism of that end part, because there's like seven different things going on at once, and it seems to want a jump cut to each of them, and you can't really comprehend those separate action sequences.
But this is
so
the
it becomes
problem.
Less like a sequence and more like a discernible montage.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the problem, isn't it? When you don't allow yourself to kill any of your expendables off, you've got your seven old guys, and then you've got your five new guys, and actually you've got a couple of new old guys because Harrison Ford turns up, and Jet Li, who's obviously too old to do any martial arts now whatsoever, also turns up, and it's like, You have to give all of these people their moments, and that means that, you know, there's just too many.
There is. At least they give the younger recruits their own moments, sort of. Half of them get decent moments, like I forget what the MMA fighter her name is, but she's basically the woman character, and her catchphrase is men. But she has some pretty decent
strong feminine.
I know
presence.
Sarcasm, sister.
Yes.
But she has some pretty decent flight sequences near the end. And the dude who, I'm just going to call him Motorbike Dude, because why not? He does some cool things on the motorbike.
Well, at least, or his stuntman does, anyway.
His stuntman does, yeah. And but then you have the other two. One includes the hacker guy, as I mentioned before. His big thing is climbing up an elevator shaft for the entire last sequence. And also being part of one of the lamest ticking time bomb sequences I've ever seen. Where he's just sitting there with like a hacking device with 30 seconds left before everything blows up around them. And you just have them just half-heartedly saying, come on, you can do it. You can do it, yeah. Come on.
Yeah, they all took a turn, didn't they? They all took a turn of going, hurry up, hurry up.
Come on, you can do it. That's cool.
But you know, I just love the fact that basically that was like the Dolph Lundgren's GPS thing from his wrist, that, you know, his weather forecasting device. You know, there's like, oh, can we have that? That's a that looks like a computer.
Well, that's sure Stallone's limited understanding to how hacking things works. If it's electronic and has to be recharged, you can hack anything in the world with it.
Yeah, yeah. And and Mel Gibson, meanwhile, stamping his feet several miles away. Yeah, look, kind of nuts. The one thing about that whole sequence that I really liked was somehow the art department found a awesome location, and you know, I'm guessing that hotel was real, and you know that it was on the verge of being demolished anyway. And you know, but all credit to them, they searched Romania or Czechoslovakia or Hungary or wherever into the far corners and found. I thought very cool. And I think full credit to the art department for what they managed to do. I believed it all was real, even the train crashing into the prison at the beginning.
Yeah, that was also very cool.
Yeah, but you know, but the sheer practicalities of what the Expendables do just bewilders me. It's like, do you really get paid enough that you can just blow up the helicopter before you know, before you leave?
Yeah.
Oh, we'll just get a new helicopter. And how did the Jeep? Where did the Jeep come from that had their logo on it that they used to get? From
they have a logo. The very fact that they have a logo means they're not covert at all. So why do they need to blow up the helicopter?
Oh boy! Now I actually do have two words for this one. So and they're marginally less lame than the last two. I would just my two words for the Expendables 3: very fighty. Do you have two, Liam?
Are we still allowed to use ampersands?
Yes. Even more so. In fact, good. Yeah, the rules are even more bendable than they ever used to be.
Okay. Well, my two-word review is... and.
Thank you very much. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. It's not quite, because we have one more thing to do. Last week on the show, I interviewed Glenn Kenny about his new book, Robert De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor. It's a really good interview. The book is a really good one, so check out last week's episode for that. This week, thanks to Penguin Books New Zealand, we have a copy to give away.
1 week turnaround. Look at that.
Not bad. Well, it hasn't arrived yet, but when it does arrive, we will give it away to somebody. Yeah, I won't read it first.
But the fact that we could give it away the following week.
Boom.
Legit.
If you want to go in the draw to win that book, your task is simple. Get in touch with us in one of our many methods that Kaylee is about to outline and tell us what your favourite Robert De Niro performance is and why. It could be two words, could be longer if you use the comment section on the blog.
Yes, so you can get in touch with us at a few ways. Grammar. First of all, of course, on Twitter, you can find us with our Twitter handle at Rancho Podcast. That's RANCHO Podcast, all one word. And also on Funeral and Snakes.
Funerals.
Funerals and Snakes.
.net.
.net / Rancho Notorious. I had to search my notes for that one. Sorry.
The entire identity for this program seems to have been designed almost deliberately to make it difficult for people to actually accidentally stumble across us. But but here we are, listeners.
Here we are. And here you are.
Yes. And my understanding from the app people is that I had to fill out a form, and now I'm waiting for them to come back to me with the form, and then okay. The apps will be ready
so
to go.
So it's legitimately on the way now.
It is absolutely on the way, but apparently there's a big queue, so we will get that. But you can find us in the iTunes store. You can rate us. Please rate us and review us, because I know it's old-fashioned, but this is the way that people discover us by accident. Mm-hmm. What else? Next week's show, we will have we're hoping to have one of our executive producers, Mark Cuby, in the Rancho Notorious studio to talk about Nick Cave's 20,000 Days on Earth. Ooh. And also ScarJo in Lucy. We'll get a Telluride and Vancouver update from Kaylee, and no doubt all the movies that you are told to go to by our listeners.
Yes.
Where is my next piece of paper? Oh,
You're interviewing the writer and director of The Last Saint?
I'm doing that on Thursday, actually. Rene Nafahu is going to be... that'll be a pre-record for next week's episode. That's right, page 4 of the script. Here we go, found you. This show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 1 is executive produced by Robert Catto, Random Films, Claire Quere, Mark Cuby, the aforementioned, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Los Plantronics, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to play you out with some more music. The best thing about The 100-Foot Journey is that it brings back the great composer A.R. Rahman, who won the Oscar for Slumdog Millionaire in 2009. Here's a track called Afrin. Special thanks to my partner Karen, who makes sure that everyone who visits here at Rancho Notorious is well fed. Sorry you couldn't be here live with us, Liam, but you got a decent amount of refreshments while you were with us.
Yeah, I'm good. I'll probably be sounding like Stallone after the next one. But yeah.
Well, you should come down and visit sometime.
Yeah, next time you're in Wellington, make sure it's on a Rancho Notorious night, and we will feed you. And
that will be very soon.
Yeah, looking forward to it. And we'll get your address so we can send you one of these limited edition Rancho Notorious buttons as well.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it's been an absolute pleasure having you here. We're off to have some dinner, so thanks very much, everyone, for listening. That's good night from me, Dan Slevin.
Good night from me.
Good night from me.